Esther, Persian name that means star. Hadassah, Hebrew name, which means myrtle. So if you know someone named Esther, you can call them myrtle just to drive them crazy. Like the tree, myrtle. The book covers a period of about 12 years. It is during the reign of Ahasuerus, which is Xerxes in contemporary history, who reigned from about 486 to 465, about 21 years. This all fits in between Ezra chapter 6 and 7. He is the grandson of Cyrus, the son of Darius the First, the father of Artaxerxes, who will give Nehemiah the right to return. So it's an important story. It gives us the beginnings of the Feast of Purim from the word lots, because of the lots that were cast here in the story from the 14th to the 16th of March of Adar, which is our March 12th month. Many times when we go to Israel, we go the last week of February, first week of March in there, because that's when the flowers are exploding out of the ground in Galilee, when we can get the spring trip where we want it. And we've been over there many times for Purim. And they have the Hamantash, Haman's ear, and celebrate God's deliverance from Haman, and Haman being executed on his own gallows. And they'll read through the whole book of Esther, and every time the name of Haman comes up, they stamp their feet and they hiss and they make noise. It's a whole thing that's wonderful, really. And it's the story of every Haman who's tried to destroy God's people and up hung on his own gallows. And so will the Hamans today on the news who are trying to destroy the nation of Israel. Because God is sovereignly and providentially watching over his chosen people. And the powers in the world that hate Israel are from dark inspirations. Anti-Semitism is satanic at its roots. Because Satan knows that Jerusalem is the city of the great king, where Jesus will take up his throne through the kingdom age, and that all of the nations of the earth will be blessed geopolitically from Israel, from Jerusalem. So we have a Haman in this story. Interesting. There is one verse in chapter 7, verse 6, and Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Numerical value, this wicked Haman, 666. Very interesting. He's a picture. He's one of our main players. Xerxes the king, one of our other main players. There's five. Vashti, his queen, one of the other players. Mordecai, we'll meet him, a Jewish man, one of the other players, and certainly Esther. I'm thinking of main characters from watching Arsenic and Old Lace the other night here at the school. If you didn't go, you missed it. Because we rented it from Blockbuster the next night to watch the movie, and it wasn't as good as the production here at school. These are the main players in this scene here. Now, it's interesting as we go through the book of Esther, because the name of God is not mentioned. Prayer is not mentioned. Sacrifice is not mentioned. Worship is not mentioned. There is a fast, but there's no prayer mentioned attached to it. None of the things that we would expect. There's no prophecy. And there's conjecture about why God is not mentioned, because probably this concerns those who have remained behind in Persia. The first deportation has returned and come back to Jerusalem. the vast number of Jews had settled now, had been under Babylon and then under Cyrus. They're in Persia. They prosper. They set up businesses and homes. And they decided to remain in that area of the world. And God had said Jerusalem was a place where he would be named. And possibly because of that, he is not named. But the interesting thing is there are five acrostics hidden in the book. The YHVH four times, and Ahyah from I Am That I Am one time. And in some of the ancient Hebrew manuscripts, the letters that form the acrostic are enlarged and made letter larger so that those can be seen. Those are in several phrases. And the interesting thing is two of them are by Gentiles. All four of them are spoken by different people. It's a phrase where when it's spoken by Hebrews, it's the name of Yahweh backwards, and it's the first, it's the way we would look at it, it's the last letter of each word, but because the Jews read the other way, it's the first letter of each word. And the two other times, it's by a Gentile, and then it would be in Hebrew, the last letter of each word, but because we're Gentiles and we read the other way, it's the first letter of each word going the other way. Got it? You know, civilization reads towards Jerusalem. We read from right to left. That's towards Jerusalem. Well, civilization is on the other side of Jerusalem. They read the other way. When, you know, it's when you go to Israel and you tell them, you guys read backwards. They say, well, it's funny. We were reading 2,000 years before America was settled. Maybe you read backwards and we read frontwards. But his name is in here. In verse 20 of chapter 1, there's a little phrase that says, all the wives shall give. Don't get excited, gals. We'll get there and tell you what that's all about. But God's name is hidden in there. The next time we find God's name in the book, it is hidden in chapter 5, verse 4, where the phrase says, let the king and Haman come this day. Chapter 5, verse 4. Then chapter 5, verse 13. Haman saying, yet, here's our phrase, all this availeth me nothing. Haman griping there, God's name hidden there. And over in chapter 7, verse 7, we have the phrase that there was evil determined against him. That's the fourth acrostic where the name Yahweh is hidden. Up in verse 5 of chapter 7, we have the Ahyah hidden in there, the I Am That I Am. Now, it's very interesting because as we go through our study, in each one of those phrases, it's an interesting juncture in the book of Esther. So, what we have here is we have a picture of God's provision, God's providence, God overseeing and sustaining his people. If they had been killed here, and that was the plan of Haman, to wipe them out, like it will be the plan of the Antichrist, then Ahasuerus, Xerxes, would not have Artaxerxes, and the command would not be given then to restore and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and the prophecies of Daniel wouldn't flow forward. This is a very interesting connection here. So God is hidden in the scene. So it gives us normal scenes in life where we see God's providence steering behind the scenes. We don't see in the sense that we would consider something miraculous sitting on the surface, but as we study the book and the interesting junctures where his name is hid, we get the idea that God is steering at those moments and steering man. You know, and it says in Acts chapter 2, that Jesus Christ was crucified by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. And there's a Granville Sharp rule there in the language which makes those things connected. And the idea is God never foreknows without foredoing. He just doesn't foreknow anything idly. As he foreknows, he's involved. And here, God's providence is involved. You know, it says in the New Testament, any man that doesn't provide for his own household has denied the faith and he's worse than an infidel. Well, that's not just making money. Provide, in the Greek, is pro horizo, pro before, horizo, horizon. Provide, from the Latin pro video, provide, to see ahead of time. And it speaks about the husband's responsibility in the home to see, to oversee, to see what's coming down the road and to make decisions in regards to that. And he's providing not just materially, but the priesthood in the home, something spiritual. Well, here's God's providence, God overseeing, hidden, not named, but his hand working plainly. And of course, for the greater part of our lives, that's the way God will work. We, in hindsight, will look back many times and say, wow, right at that time, wow, if this hadn't happened, now I see why. You know, I was complaining. I was saying, Lord, if you love me, why is this happening? Now I know why that was happening. Now I see his hand. Well, his hand is seen throughout the book, though he is not named. He is not seen. His hand is evident throughout. Let's jump in. Let's look at these characters and watch the story develop in an interesting way. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, which was the title of the Persian kings. His name was actually Xerxes, like Pharaoh was the king of Egypt. This is the Ahasuerus which reigned, telling us which Persian king, from India even to Ethiopia, over 127 127 provinces, the largest expanse of the Persian Empire at this point in time. That in those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, which was the winter palace, because you didn't have central air or forced hot air heat in those days, so when in the summer, in the winter, you moved somewhere where it was a little warmer. That was Shushan. In the summer, you moved to one of the palaces a little bit cooler. That was your air conditioning and heating. You moved to a different climate. In the third year of his reign, and we're going to see his reign mark now. That's where we're being introduced to him. The third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. The power of Persia and Media and the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. So this is a 180-day party. 6 months. And he has all of these guys gathered from all of his provinces, and you know that this is a shindig. His grandfather, Cyrus, who had not expanded the kingdom to the point that it's expanded under Xerxes, the daily provision at the table of Cyrus, just for his court, now this wasn't for all of the nobles or princes coming from all over the provinces, for his own court, was 400 sheep, 300 lambs, 100 oxen, 30 horses, matters your taste, I guess, 30 deer, 400 geese, 100 young geese, 300 pigeons, 600 small fowls, and 3,750 gallons of wine every day, 75 gallons of new milk and 75 gallons of sour milk. That's besides 2,200 loaves of bread minimum per day. That's at the regular court of Cyrus. That's not when he's having a party. So we have to, you know, multiply that. This is the court of Ahasuerus of Xerxes, and it's a larger court in the first place, and he has all of these people coming from all the provinces. Now, what he's doing is this. His father, Darius I, was defeated by the Greeks, who are the up-and-coming power. Remember, Daniel said, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, that's Medo-Persia, then the belly and thighs of bronze. Greece is arising as a power. He has put down a rebellion in Babylon, Xerxes. He's had a victory in regards to the Egyptians. But what has rubbed him the wrong way is that his father, Darius I, was defeated by the Greeks in a particular battle in Marathon. And now he is building support. That's why he's having this party. He's building a coalition. And he wants to go now and have a naval battle with the Greeks. So he has all of these leaders and nobles and everything from his province, and they come and he shows them the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days. What do you think that party looked like? Well, we don't have to envy anybody who was there, because it says of our king, in the ages to come, he's still going to be revealing his grace and glory. It will take ages for Jesus Christ to reveal his glory and his grace. And even then, every time we look up, our minds will be blown again. It will never get old. There will be, because he's infinite, it will never end. But this is some bash. You can bet your life on that. 6 months of a party here. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan in the palace. This is an after party. Both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now this is in a particular area in the garden. Listen to this. Where were white, green, and blue hangings, tapestries on the walls, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings, and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and of silver, upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. Some digs. That's a place, I'll tell you. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, and the vessels being diverse one from another. Now, they're so wealthy that every cup, gold cup, in his kitchen cabinet was different from another one. You know, there's two reasons that can happen. Either you're very wealthy, or in our house, none of the glasses match either in the kitchen cabinet. That's for a completely different reason. They were diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. Now, history says that Xerxes, out of the three dominant Persian kings, which were Darius I, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes, that he was the tallest, he was the most handsome, but he was given to fits of rage. He loved to be drunk and to party. He was a man that the book of Ecclesiastes talks about, that had everything and that had nothing. The drinking, verse 8, was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers and to his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. So no one told you how little to drink, and no one told you how much to drink. That was a law. Xerxes passed. You could drink as much or as little as you wanted. Also, Vashti, which has the idea of beautiful, Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So there's another party going on where the women are gathered together. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, now it seems to me that it should happen in a lot less than 7 days, this guy. On the seventh day, this is after drinking for 6 months, and now an additional 7 days, finally his heart is merry. He commanded, I don't know if these names were given before or after they started drinking, Mehuman Bitha Harbona Bigtha Abtha, you know, Ebagtha, Zather, Carcass. This guy's really gone. And the seven eunuchs, it says chamberlains here in the King James, they were eunuchs that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king. It would be common to castrate the court servants and make them eunuchs so they would never be tempted to set up their own dynasty, because they couldn't have their own children, they couldn't reproduce, so they would end up then to be faithful to the dynasty that was in place. So he gives a command now to the eunuchs who watch the harem to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king with the crown royal upon her head, is the idea, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look upon. Now, when the Holy Spirit says that a woman is fair to look upon, he doesn't say that many times in the Bible. She's fair to look upon. So she must have been a beauty. But Queen Vashti refused. Now look, we're not sure what's going on here. Some have suggested that she's already pregnant with Artaxerxes. We don't know that. There are some suggestions that he's saying to come with nothing but the crown on to show off her beauty. We don't know that. The whole thing, you know, that he's there pickled with all of his friends. They've been drinking for 7 days. They can't even say their names. One guy's called Carcass now. He's passed out on the floor. And they want to now, he wants to march his wife in, who he should have protected, but he wants to march her in and make a, you know, an object of her because of her beauty in front of all of these guys. She refuses. Now she knows the consequences that could cost her her life. And that's the kind of man that Xerxes was. Xerxes, at one point in time when he was getting ready to go war against the Greeks, a prominent family in Persia came to him and wanted to make a contribution, and they had Greek ancestry, but wanted to make a contribution to him to go to the war. He was so impressed with their contribution that he funded the war out of his own pocket, because he thought, if they're willing to do that, why shouldn't I? But that same family, at a different battle, when they asked Xerxes if their son could be spared, because they had already lost their other son in war, Xerxes took that son and split him in half and laid the two halves on the road and marched his army between. So he's not a pleasant guy. He had built a bridge, and it had been wiped out by a storm. So he went and executed everybody who worked on the bridge. There were thousands, all of his foremen, everyone, and then ordered that the water should be whipped. That's the kind of guy he was. He was probably drunk when he did that, but they were punishing the water for ruining his bridge. They whipped it, and they threw shackles into the water. You know, he thought he'd been drinking too much that he could shackle the water. So this is not a guy you want to push in the wrong direction. We have to hand it to Vashti. We don't know much about her. Secular literature doesn't tell us about Vashti. But the scripture gives us this picture that she was willing to lose everything rather than to make herself an object of desire, rather than surrender herself to this, which shouldn't have never been asked. The Queen Vashti refused to come in at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth. That's not good. And his anger burned in him. I mean, he's got all of these nobles, all the people came, and he's trying to get them to go to war with him against Greece, and he can't even conquer his wife. So this doesn't look good for him in the middle of all of this. So he is not happy. He's drunk and he's angry. Then the king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner towards all that knew law and judgment. And the next unto him was, Karshina, Shether, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, Mamukan. That doesn't sound good. the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. They were prominent leaders. What shall we do unto Queen Vashti, he says, according to the law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? What's the law say? What are we going to do? Well, Mamukin, verse 16, answers before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all of the princes and to all of the people that are in all of the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all the women, so that they shall all despise their husbands in their eyes. When it shall be reported that King Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought before him, and she committed, she didn't just sin against you, she sinned against all of us. If word gets out that she ain't listened to you, then all of our wives are going to start to act like Mrs. Mamukin. Must have been something to walk in fear of. He's saying this is they're all drunk, all these guys. This ain't good. There's going to be problems for all of us. Has he? You know, he can see them drunk. It's a women's lib movement starting here. We can't let word of this get. If it gets on the evening news, we are all in trouble. This is before the National Organization of Women. This is the Persian Organization of Women, which is PAL, which is way worse than now. So you don't want Mrs. Mamukin and PAL coming around. There was some pipeline there they were worried about. There was no radio or TV, but there's a pipeline in the church. You know how that works. This is not good. You see these guys all pickled. Well, then all of our wives find out and start acting like her. You know, this is going to be bad for everybody. Likewise, shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, which have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. So, if it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him. Let it be written among the laws of the Persians and of the Medes, that it be not altered. Now, you remember in Daniel chapter 6, it says that the law of the Medes and Persians is a law that cannot be altered once it is written. It was different with Nebuchadnezzar. He was a pure monarch, and he could change his mind, and he could cut off your head and make your house a dunghill. He could do whatever he wanted. But according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, once a law was written, it could not be altered. That's how they tried to get Daniel in the lion's den. You remember the things that went on there. So these guys are all pickled. Let's pass a law. Let's write a royal commandment. According to the Medes and the Persians, it can't be altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate and her credit cards and everything unto another that is better than her. Give all of her stuff to somebody else. We'll fix her. Now here's our first acrostic comes in here. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both to the great, the small, and the drunk. So, you know, we'll pass this decree and make our wives behave. That's what we'll do. Well, you know, here's the first place where the name of God is hidden in this drunken party, where these guys are paranoid of their wives and what's going to happen if word gets out. God's steering. His name is hidden, beginning to set the stage for Vashti to be set aside and for a door to be opened that Esther will enter in through. Very interesting. And the saying pleased the king. I bet it did. The saying pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Mamukin. When he got home, Mrs. Mamukin said, were you involved? We heard you were in the middle of the path. Not me, honey. I don't want to do it. It was them. When I had a different idea. Mrs. Mamukin should be... For he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, into every province, according to the writing thereof. Now, just a side note, the ancient Persia at this time had the fastest mail delivery system in the ancient world. It was very much like the Pony Express in America. They would have stables at certain distances, and they would have race horses, and the mail would be delivered. A guy would jump on one horse and race till the horse was ready to drop to the next stable, jump off, the next horse would be ready, jump back on, and mail was carried like that, like Pony Express. So it'll be sent to all the provinces according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house. You see the bunch of drunks making these laws. This is funny. That every man shall bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language. And we want it to go into every language, everywhere. Everybody needs to know. It's a great law. Well, that's kind of the end of the party. There are 4 years between chapter 1 and chapter 2. And in there, there's the two-year, the period 3 years from 41 to 479 B.C., where there are two campaigns against the Greeks where Xerxes suffers defeat. And he comes then back to his palace broken, dejected. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he sobered up, time has gone by, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what was the decree against her. Now, evidently, you know, she was fair to look upon, a beautiful woman, and evidently by her refusal to come in, we learn a little bit about her character, too. She was an Abigail, spiritual and beautiful, very rare, except here in our church, of course, in the Bible, in the Old Testament. He now seems to be kind of mourning over the fact that he had made a stupid decision when he was drunk. Then said the king's servants, they must see him bummed out, that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. Now, probably these guys don't want Vashti back, because if they were part of making a law, they know if she gets back in, we're goners. Let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all of the provinces, 127 provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of women, unto the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, one of the chief eunuchs, keeper of the women, and let their things be for purification be given to them. And let the maiden which pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king. I guess it did. And he did so. So he's going to have a Miss Universe pageant now. And he's going to pick the one that he likes best. How about if we go through 127 provinces and gather the most beautiful virgins out of each one and bring them all here and fix them all up and make them smell and look real pretty, and you just try them all out and take the one you like the best? Well, that sounds good. This is a real crew of guys here, I'll tell you. Now, in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. And that's a Babylonian name, evidently born in captivity. The son of Jair, the son of Shemai, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. He seems to be in the palace. We're not sure what position he has, but he is here in the palace. And it says that Mordecai was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, we're going to assume from the grammar what it's saying is Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shemai, the son of Kish, a man of Benjamin who had been carried away, that his great-grandfather Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar, because if we try to fit Mordecai and Esther into this slot, it would make Mordecai over 115 years old, and it would make Esther over 80. And I doubt whether she's winning the beauty contest here, Miss Universe pageant. So the grammar allows, and it would seem then is telling this is man Mordecai is of this family. His grandfather Kish, a Benjaminite, was carried away. That's how his family ended up there. When Jeconiah was king, and Nebuchadnezzar was carrying people away from Babylon, and he brought up, nourished, Hadassah, Myrtle, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful. Now, this one's not just fair to look on, this one is fair and beautiful. Whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So there is no doubt a great connection between Mordecai and to raise a tender young girl. And here the text gives us not only her Persian name, but Hadassah. She was Hadassah to this old man Mordecai. He had raised her and cared for her as his own daughter. And there is a promise in Scripture for those who will care for the orphan and for the widow. They have a particular place in God's heart. And this young orphan girl, we have no sense of bitterness as we meet Esther and we look at her life. God will choose this orphan to direct the course of human history. This one girl, for such a time as this. You know, sometimes we can look back at our lives and what we may have been robbed of, without a father, without a mother, or an abusive situation. And sometimes I think there comes a point in our lives where we bow the knee to God's sovereignty and say, Lord, I'm going to lay down the idol of a perfect home, and I'm going to accept your will that you've allowed this to happen, because these were the necessary things for me to be who I am. And somehow in your wisdom and your sovereignty, you allow painful things in life. Lord, let those things forge into my character those kinds of things that will serve your purposes now and in the days ahead. Again, you know, it's interesting. Some of my favorite men in ministry, Greg Laurie, Mike McIntosh, Raul Reese, grew up in foster homes, alcoholic fathers. Mike hated his dad. Raul wanted to kill his dad. Abusive, alcoholic. And yet those guys are great evangelists. They have a tremendous burden for the lost, for the broken person. Just God using them in a tremendous way. Some of my favorite teachers, pastors, Chuck and Don McClure and John Corson, came from very stable homes with a mother and father, and they are certainly more pastoral, more stable, more, and I'm sure that's just a generality, that it's not some kind of spiritual rule, but the point is, I know some remarkable human beings who have come from horrendous situations, who God has used in an incredible way to set a generation free, to touch the lives of untold thousands of people. And part of their brokenness lends itself to what they are today. Here's this orphan, Hadassah, mother and father killed, raised by this uncle, Mordecai, this man, as his own daughter. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Haggai, that Esther was brought. Now Josephus said that she protested. We have no record of that here in the scripture. That Esther was brought also under the king's house to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him. Esther pleased Xerxes. And she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and 7 maidens, which were fitting, meet to be given to her out of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maidens unto the best place of the house of women, gave her the nicest accommodations in the palace. Now, she's silent here. There doesn't seem to be protest. It says in verse 10, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred. She didn't let Xerxes know that she was Jewish. She had not showed her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. So Mordecai said, don't let the king know that you're Jewish. For whatever reason, God is overriding. There's providence here. There's a sovereignty at work here. Quietly, behind the scenes, steering, orchestrating. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. So you can see him walking by every day, you know, just finding out from Esther what's going on. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go into the king, they got nerve calling that a turn, I guess. When their turn was come to go into the king Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months, so each woman took 12 months, according to the manner of women. You know, I get tired waiting for my wife for 15 minutes if we're late going somewhere. This is a year. It took them a year to get ready. After the manner of women. For so were the days of their purification accomplished. That is, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with sweet odors. These are desert women. I guess they're a little tough. 6 months there to oil them up and soften them up. And 6 months with perfume, I guess. You know, 12 months, they're done. Okay, bring them in. The desert women are tough. 6 months with sweet odors and with other things for the purifying of the young women. Then, thus came every maiden unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given to her to go with her out of the house of women unto the king's house. Whatever outfit she wanted to wear, I guess whatever perfume she wanted to wear. In the evening, she went, and on the next day, she returned into the second house of the women to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's chamberlain, one of the other eunuchs, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she was called by name. So she would go in to the king. He would enjoy her sexual favors. The next day she would go to the harem. And somehow the king's going through this whole process to decide who he likes best. No doubt a lonely life. There may have been times once in your entire life. You know, the women in the harem were taken care of extremely well. But often may have gone their whole life after this and not even have seen the king. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing. Want any makeup? Nah. Lipstick? Nah. Want this perfume? It's called poison. Nah. How about passion? Nah. How about seduction? Nah. She required nothing. But what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of women, appointed. So he contributed because he probably didn't want his head cut off. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month of Tabith. Now notice, in the 7th year of his reign. And back in chapter 1, verse 3, remember, we were in the 4th year of his reign. And God here working, keeping time of all of this. And the king loved Esther above all of the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all of the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all the princes and all of his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Now, he has some place there, we're not told. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, hadn't yet let the king know that she was Jewish, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. Interesting, he's still a covering to her. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, they sound like mean guys to me. Sounds like Bigfoot or something there, White Fang, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth. Now these guys are cooking over something, they're angry, and sought to lay hand on King Ahasuerus. There's treason. They cook up some kind of plot, and they're going to kill Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai. He happened to be sitting there in the gate. He must overhear this. Who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king. She let the king know thereof in Mordecai's name. She says, my stepfather, Mordecai, said these two men are planning treason. There's a plot to take your life, an assassination plot. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So these two now are hanged on a tree. They weren't hanged on a gallows like in the Wild West. They were impaled. Hanged on a tree would be to take a huge stake and impale them on a stake. There was a time when Darius, I believe, the father of Xerxes, had impaled over 3,000 men along the side of a road for some thing that had taken place. Now, the interesting thing is, and read ahead next week, we'll head into the third chapter. After these things, the king promotes Haman. He's an Agagite. And we're going to find out that means his lineage is that he was an Amalekite. The Amalekites were to be wiped out by Saul, the king. You remember as Samuel came and he said, what is this blowing of oxen and bleeding of sheep in my ears? Because he told him to kill all the sheep, kill all the oxen. And he said, well, he kept Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive for a particular reason. And then he kept the sheep and the best of the oxen for slaughter. And he said, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is like idolatry. To hearken is better than the fat of rams, and so forth. And then Saul will lose the throne. And because Saul didn't wipe out the Amalekites, now Mordecai, who is a Benjamite, the same tribe in his family, once again being plagued by the Amalekites, which is a type of the flesh. He's a type of that. He will be a type of the Antichrist. We'll see that as we move through. But the interesting thing is now we move into this period where Xerxes, the king, forgets that Esther told him it was Mordecai who discovered this plot. And Haman, who's the rat, he gets elevated instead. Now, you ever been in a situation like that? At work or school or somewhere? Where you're the one who turns something up, you're the one who discovers something, you're the one who does something good, and the rat gets elevated? Ever been there? And you've been forgotten about? You know, sometimes it can be divine amnesia. In Egypt, when Joseph was in the dungeon, and the baker and the king's cook were there with him, they had dreams. Joseph interpreted their dreams, and he said, you're going to be taken out of prison, you're going to be restored, and his head's going to get lopped off. And sure enough, that's what happened. Joseph said, only remember me when you get out of here. Remember me. And the one man was restored to his high position with Pharaoh, and the other guy, his head was lopped off. And it says, and the baker forgot about Joseph. 2 more years in the dungeon. Every time he hears a door, is that the baker? No. 2 more years sitting there cooking. 2 more years wondering if he's ever going to see home, if he's ever going to get out. But there's a night when Pharaoh, we don't know if he eats too much pepperoni pizza, whatever he does before he goes to bed, and then he has these crazy dreams about skinny cows and fat cows and ears of grain and so forth. And then the baker goes, duh, there's this guy in prison. He interprets dreams. He did it for me. And God didn't let the baker remember until Pharaoh's dreams. Because it was that step that was set Joseph over the most dominant kingdom in the world to preserve the children of Israel. That means that there may be times in life when God deliberately has somebody forget about you and give you the dirty end of the stick. And you want to strangle them, and God took their memory away. Because they're not allowed to remember until his time signature has approved of them remembering. We're going to see the same thing here. Xerxes is going to be sitting around, you know, he can't sleep one night, he's up. And he goes and starts looking through the royal records, and at the right time he realizes that Mordecai was involved, and that's when the stage is set and everything will work out the way it's supposed to for Haman to get hung on his own gallows, for the Jewish people to be preserved. God's plan. So be careful when someone forgets, when someone doesn't deliver, when someone doesn't do what they say they're going to do, because sometimes it can be a case of divine memory loss. And the timing of God can be involved. In this book, as we read through, as we go forward, that's what we're going to see. The providence of God, the sovereignty of God, quietly behind the scenes, moving, stirring, directing, bringing things to memory, putting things on people's hearts, making them say particular things at certain times, and setting the course of human history. Very important to us because, by and large, that's the way God works in our lives. Not out in the open. He's there. He loves us. He's working. And I know in my life, and certainly in yours, and more as time goes on, we can look back and we can see those junctures where there was some divine appointment, there was something that God did, and we say, Lord, I see that now. I was griping. I was complaining. I didn't know what was going on. I thought you forgot about me, this or that. And all the while, Lord, your love, your sovereignty, your wisdom, your grace, your mercy was overriding. Reminds, you know, sometimes we remind me of, I was at the Philadelphia airport one time and saw this mom walking with a little kid. He couldn't have been older than 2 years old, and he didn't want to go where she was going, so she had him by the hand and was dragging him. And his feet were just dragging. And she's dragging him through the airport, and he's yelling, help! Somebody, help! Help! And you could tell she was mad. She was just marching and just dragging him. And sometimes I feel that's how I am with the Lord, you know. Help! But he's just dragging me. He's got to get me to a flight. He's got to get me to an appointment. He's got to get me somewhere. Well, we see these things happening in the book of Esther. So it is a great book to overlay on our lives. Many lessons. I encourage you to read ahead.